Welcome to the 206th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Jeff Summers, author of We Are Not Good People. This episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast is sponsored by Orlando Sanchez, author of A Dream of Ashes, an Ava James mystery, available as an ebook or paperback now. Again, the name of the book is A Dream of Ashes, an Ava James mystery, sponsor of this episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. Stay tuned for my interview with Jeff Summers, author of We Are Not Good People. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Jeff Summers, author of We Are Not Good People. Summers is also the author of the Avery Cates series of noir science fiction thrillers. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Jeff, thanks very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Sure. Well, I wondered if you could read a couple of pages from your new novel, We Are Not Good People.
Sure. I'll just pick it up from the beginning with the two main characters, Lem and Mags, who are sort of low-level magicians, are in a desperate search for something, anything that will give them an advantage.
Great.
So chapter one, there's a girl in the tub, Mag said. I looked up at him. His hair was getting long. It was glossy and silky, a grand black forest of hair. His eyebrows almost met in the middle, giving him a permanently sinister expression. I cannot actually pronounce his actual last name and called him Peter Mags because it was better than calling him Peter the Indian Bastard. Excuse me. A 50-year-old dead girl, I asked, thinking bones and webs, a fine bed of off-white dust lining the tub beneath it. He shook his head, pushing his bandaged fingers into his pockets. Recent. I paused in the act of tearing up the carpet. We were broke again. Sometimes it seemed like we'd done all of this before, an endless cycle of failure. The last $17 we'd possessed had been spent on Nielsen, passed over with a pinprick of gas to make it look like 340 in 20s. And all Mags and I had to our names was what was pumping in our veins. We were fucking incompetent. In all things, we'd failed. We were wallowing in a nice, comfy pit of fucking spectacular failure, deep black and hermetically sealed. Me and Mags bound together forever and ever with deep fishhook ties of ruin. I hauled myself to my feet, fished in my jacket pocket, produced a fresh bandage, and began working the thin wrapper free, difficult due to the damp and soiled bandages that adorned all nine of my other fingers, and the fresh slice oozing blood on my index finger. Faint sparks of pain flared from my fingertips as I worked at it. I was careful not to let any blood drip anywhere, get smeared anywhere, leave no mark. That was rule one. No trace of yourself. Blood was usable for only a few seconds, 10, 20. After that, you couldn't burn it away no matter how big the spell. Best not to take chances. The apartment was supposed to have been a good score. We'd heard that Nielsen had a card up his sleeve and the old drunk had a sheen of success about him, despite floating around our social level, which should have been our first clue. But Nielsen had been a pilot back a few decades, and he worked art, and thus had an aura of intellect and culture that was powerful attractive to men like Mags and me, small minds drenched in blood and peasant fare. The codger spoke with an adorable accent, and I had never gotten past the childish idea that all people with some sort of accented English must be fucking geniuses. When sober, Nielsen was a good operator, and he'd made some decent cash from time to time, so we took the rumor seriously, and decided to work with him the only way Mags and I could. A little bit of charm, a little bit of booze, and a little bit of gas. I think that's probably a good place to stop, actually.
Right. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about We Are Not Good People yet, how would you describe your new novel?
This would be sort of a noir urban fantasy, I guess, would be a good way to put it. In this universe, which is sort of modeled very heavily on the real world, magic actually does exist, but it's not known by many people. Anybody could cast a magic spell, but the way you fuel a magic spell is through blood sacrifice. A very small spell requires a very little bit of blood. A very powerful spell requires a whole lot of blood. And throughout history, very powerful magic users who are called Ustari in this book have actually engineered, you know, disasters, wars, you know, horrible catastrophes in order to kill enough people to obtain the blood they need for their magical rites. And our two main characters, Mags and Lem, they're pretty skilled magic users, but they have a moral objection to using anybody else's blood. And so they only cast spells that they can bleed for themselves, which of course limits them a great deal, what they can achieve.
Great. Well, do you remember the initial idea that led you to writing We Are Not Good People?
You know, it started probably, gosh, about 25 years ago. I wrote a short story, and the short story has nothing really to do with the novel, but it was during a fairly pretentious period of my life where I was trying to write short stories that had, you know, big ideas and meant something. And this one particular story had one scene that always stuck with me where the narrator of the story walked out of a diner in the middle of the night. And when he walks into the parking lot, he sees an old man just sort of hovering, levitating in the middle of the parking lot with pigeons landing on him. And, you know, then it was supposed to be this powerful moment in the story. Of course, the story itself was a complete failure, and that moment really didn't land. But the image stuck with me. And I began wondering, who was this old man? Why, you know, why would he just be hovering in the middle of the parking lot? And that image eventually grew into the character of Lem and his mentor character in the book, who's the older, more experienced magician who teaches him all about magic.
And was that short story that you just mentioned, was that published?
No, it never was.
It never was. Say that again. Sorry.
And likely never should have been.
Okay. And I wasn't clear from what you were saying. Were you at that point trying to write kind of mainstream or literary stories with just interesting images, or would you have considered that story speculative fiction?
That would have been more of a mainstream literary attempt. I went through what I imagine is not an atypical period in my life when I went off to college and suddenly began reading all of these great novels and short stories. When I was a kid, when I was growing up and, you know, through grammar school, through high school, I was a pretty dedicated sci-fi fantasy reader. Then I went off to school and suddenly I was reading, you know, great works of literature, and I got a little bit, you could say inspired, you could also just say pretentious, and decided that that's what I needed to do. And sort of walked away from sci-fi for a while and spent a few very unsatisfying years attempting to be more lofty in my literary goals, which I now realize it doesn't really mean anything. You can be lofty in your literary goals no matter what genre you're working in.
Sure. So what led you from writing, you know, those types of pretentious stories back to kind of the literature that, in your words, you loved, science fiction and fantasy?
I was trapped in a job, working, you know, sitting in a cubicle. And one day I literally Googled how to get paid to write, and, which again, I'm sure is not an atypical thing for aspiring writers to do. And it turned up a link to an online web publisher who no longer exists. And they were called Another Chapter. And they had this truly bizarre business model. What they wanted to do was serial fiction. And they wanted to get subscribers to pay them, I think it was $5 a month, and you would get one chapter of a book every week emailed to you. And they were taking proposals for all sorts of genres. And I had an old science fiction book that I had written when I was about 18 or 19 years old that had been sitting in a drawer. And I thought, just as an exercise, really, how about if I pull that out and I'll put together a proposal for them? Because they had a very strict you know, system for proposing a book for them, because I found that the less a publisher is going to pay you, the more difficult it is to actually get through their submission process. So they wanted character sketches. They wanted, you know, a detailed synopsis of the entire book broken down into chapters, and all that. So I said, you know, just as an exercise, just because I have this book sitting here, I haven't done anything with it, let me work it up. And they liked what I did, and they, you know, they accepted it. And then they managed to publish about 12 chapters before they went out of business, which is probably about 10 chapters more than I would have expected them to do. But that sort of reignited it for me. The book, that was The Electric Church, which is the first book in the Avery Cates series. And that, I had so much fun reworking it. I had so much fun getting back into that universe that I ran with it. And that was the second book I ever published, actually.
Gotcha. Well, you mentioned earlier that that was a novel, that the one that you pulled out of a drawer that you had written when you were 18 or 19. What has been kind of your interest in writing? When did that start for you?
Oh, I hate to sound like a terrible cliche, but it's since I was a little kid. I think the story I always tell is that when I was very small, and this was back in the days before we didn't even have cable TV, much less a VCR of any kind. You know, this was back when you had 12 channels and then the UHF dial. At some point, they aired on television the animated version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. And I was really taken with it. You know, I really enjoyed it. But back when I was a kid, you know, when you saw something on television, it disappeared forever. You know, it very rarely were things rerun, you know, and if they were rerun, it was always sort of a shock. You know, oh my God, today at 4 o'clock in the morning, they're rerunning this show. So I was very, even at that young age, which was probably 7 or 8 years old, you know, I was very conditioned to be like, oh, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. I'll never see it again. And then we were taken on one of those forced field trips to the library in school, you know, where they march you down. I don't know if they do this everywhere, but in Jersey City, New Jersey, when I was a kid, they would take the entire class and march us down to the local branch of the library. And you would be ordered to get one book at least, and which you would have to do a report on. And of course, I went in there and I was looking for a book about magic tricks, or possibly Reggie Jackson would have been a suitable subject. You know, I was just very excited about that. And I remember very distinctly walking by a bookshelf, and there was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it had never actually occurred to me before that things on television might have source material, that there might have been something it was based on. And this was just absolutely mind-blowing to little Jeff. I mean, little Jeff just stood there and was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. Not only that, but there were 6 other books that were, you know, sequels to that one that just extended the story. And that just paralyzed me. It's like, oh my God. And I started taking those 7 books out week in and week out. I would take them all out. I would bring them back. I would take them out again. And I just reread them over and over again. It was such an amazing moment for me to think that I could experience the story anytime I wanted to. And that's what set me on the road, because then when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time pretending, you know, to be different things. I go, you know, all kids do that. I was an astronaut. I was a magician. I was a spy. And then I started to pretend I was a writer. And my mom had this ancient old manual Remington typewriter. And I basically stole it from her, and I would just sit there, and it started off just purely pretending. And then over time I actually started writing little stories, and I just never stopped.
That's a great story. Well, I know you made the switch from science fiction noir with your Avery Kate series to, as you mentioned earlier, kind of a noir urban fantasy with We Are Not Good People. Was that a deliberate choice to switch from science fiction thrillers to supernatural or urban fantasy?
Yes and no. When I finished the 5th book of the Avery Kate series, The Final Evolution, I had been at that point, I had written 4 novels in 5 years, basically. And while that's not a punishing pace at all, it was a lot of time to spend in one universe with one character. And it was also the first time in those 4 years that I wasn't under contract and I was sort of free to do whatever I wanted to do. So there was sort of a conscious edging away from the cyberpunk noir sci-fi kind of thing going on with Kate's. And I wanted to do something a little bit different. But I do think the books in a lot of ways have a lot of tonal similarities. I think the universes are actually similar in a sense, even though We Are Not Good People is set in a very realistic universe, except for the fact that, you know, except for the tiny fact that magic is possible. It's basically this time and this day and age. But it actually in my mind, in the back of my mind, subconsciously, the books are linked in a way. Mm-hmm. Because I actually see the Avery Kate's universe as literally the future that's coming in the We Are Not Good People universe.
Right. Right.
And I've even actually played with the idea that Kate's ancestors are in that universe right now. And I've played with the idea of even having a character named Kate's in there. That would be like his great, 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 great grandfather. But that would be purely for my own amusement. And there's far too much of that in my books already. So I'm sort of backed away from that a little bit.
Gotcha. So what is your writing process like? Do you outline extensively or do you write more organically?
I did a presentation at a conference a year ago, talking about just that subject, and the terms pantsing and plotting, you know, like when you write by the seat of your pants and you're just pantsing along, as opposed to outlining everything very carefully. And I came up with the term plantsing, because I always start off when I was younger, I was definitely an inveterate pantser. I just made everything up as I went along. I completely disdained any kind of outlining. And part of it was for me, when I outline too extensively, it's very much like I'm writing it already in my head. And then when it's time to sit down and actually write it, it's sort of like keyboarding. It's like transcribing what I've already done. And it's a little more boring and it's a little more laborious for me, because I don't have that spark of discovery anymore. So I used to just always sit down and just bang it out. And then I would go back later and try and figure out where the problems were and, you know, what needed to be done. These days, what I do now is I start off sort of pantsing along. I'll start off just writing off the top of my head. But when I run into trouble, when I run into plot difficulties or, you know, writer's block or something like that, I've taken to actually stopping where I am and then going back, going through what I've already written and outlining a little bit from there. You know, I'll start by creating a skeleton outline of what I've already created just to make sure it all hangs together and that they're, you know, it sort of makes sense. And then I'll outline a little bit further from there. And this way you can do sort of branch offs, you know, what if I did this and see what happens, or what if I did this and see what happens. And then once I feel like I've gotten back in control of the story, then I go back to just making it up as I go along.
Gotcha. Well, given your success in publishing the Avery Cates series and now We're Not Good People, what advice would you have for aspiring writers who may be listening, who would one day like to have their own novels and stories published?
I don't think I have any magic words of wisdom. And I think probably most writers have this reaction when they're asked this question. It all boils down to, you know, do the work. There are no shortcuts. I submitted a lot of manuscripts. I wrote a lot of query letters, before I landed an agent, before I sold the novel. I don't think there's any real other way around it, unless you have some special connections, which is a whole other situation. And if you do have special connections, do not hesitate. You know, don't feel bad about that. Use them, for God's sakes. I'm not one who resents people who have, you know, an uncle, you know, who can get them a contract. Go for it. You know, you call your uncle, for God's sakes. But otherwise, you know, submit, take feedback that you get and think about it. Doesn't mean you have to, you know, agree with it and work with it, but think about it every time you get some, and just keep at it. There's really nothing else you can do.
Gotcha. So do you feel like you know things now in terms of publishing or even just the writing and the work that you may wish that you had known earlier?
You know, the main thing that I wish I had known prior to selling The Electric Church, Avery Cates number one, is that publishers, especially in genre, but I think in general, they always want the second novel. They always want you to have ideas for the next book. Mm-hmm. I sort of fell into a trap, and I think a lot of writers fall into a trap of, you spend so much time working on that one novel, you know, that first book. And then when you sell it, it's wonderful and it's celebratory, but then they say, okay, what's your follow-up? And you can easily find yourself in a position where you've got 6 months to go from idea to finished manuscript, you know? And so you have a situation where your first book took you 10 years and you were able to revise and route it through beta readers and research things and really, really scrub it down to a fine polish. And then you've got a very short window of time to draw out the second book. Because when I published the Electric Church, I didn't have a strong sense of sequels. I didn't know where I was going to go with it from the end of that book. And, you know, the publisher offered me a two-book deal. A three-book deal. And then they threw two more books on top of it a few years later. And I got there. You know, I was able to you know, sit down and think about it really hard. And I came up with, you know, a series that I'm very proud of, and I took it to a place that I'm very proud of. But it was sort of a shock for me at the moment because I had put all my energy into that first book. And if you think you've got a chance to sell a book, you should be thinking about your follow-up.
Gotcha. And what was that process like for you? Was there any trepidation in terms of writing the fourth or fifth book when the earlier books had already been published, just in terms of kind of the overarching story? Were there times where you were like, oh, I wish I could go back and rewrite that? Or
I didn't have any storytelling regrets. I did start to have a sense that some of the people who really enjoyed the first book and the second book didn't come with me where I went on the third, fourth, and fifth books, because I definitely took it into sort of an apocalyptic direction. Mm-hmm. I had an idea when the sequels came up, you know, which was, it's always delightful, of course, when a publisher says, hey, can you write four more of these? And when that came up, I thought about, what do I want to do with this story? I've created this universe. I've got this character. And I decided fairly early on that over the course of the sequels, I wanted to tell the story of a civilization falling apart, you know, basically the world ending in a way. Not necessarily from an asteroid impact or, you know, alien invasion, but just from entropy, just from, you know, civilization losing cohesion and falling apart. And so the story got bleak, you know, it got very bleak very quickly. And I do think there were some people who really enjoyed the first book, and I started to get the sense from, you know, reviews and emails that I was getting that they weren't coming with me on the journey. So I don't necessarily regret that. But it was definitely something that hung over me a little bit as I was writing the last book.
Mm-hmm. And did you just kind of try to ignore that as you wrote?
Yeah. On the one hand, I had sort of committed by that point, you know.
Yeah.
it would have been sort of an interesting twist if all of a sudden, you know, I had my character wake up in the last 2 years yeah. of the plot where it was all a dream. I'm Bobby Ewing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it was also, that's what I wanted to do. You know, from the first moment I knew I had a chance to tell a story over a multiple book series, I knew that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to have a definite trajectory, and I wanted it to be bigger than just the individual character's experience. I wanted it to be more on a global scale.
Gotcha. So what books, fiction or nonfiction, have you read in the past year that made an impression on you and that you would mention or recommend?
Let's see, throughout the last year,
or a year or two,
it's always hard to think about, you know, it's one of those questions where people say to you, you know, what have you read recently that you love? And you, I always draw a blank. So I'm going to have to, go down to my bookshelf here and just take a quick look at what I actually have read recently. I know I'm a little bit late to the party, but I read The Goldfinch this year by Donna Tartt and really enjoyed that. I think it's one of those books that some people don't quite get why it got such a reception and why it won the Pulitzer Prize. And I think there's so much going on in that book that it's definitely a book I'm going to go back to and read again at some point, try and catch everything that's in there. Let's see what else is on here. I tend to read a lot of older books, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Or fortunately, I'm a big fan. I like to go to used bookstores and pick up books from, you know, 30 or 40 years ago and, you know, pay a dollar for them.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting to me that, you know, we put such a premium on new, you know, new books. Every book was new at some point.
And, oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, especially when these books aren't necessarily famous books that you read about in class or that you know, constantly see mentioned in blogs and stuff. It's fascinating to see a book that was a bestseller in 1960 that no one ever talks about anymore. Right. So I like to think
of any of those stand out in your mind?
What did I read recently that I really loved? I do apologize. I'm trying to think of
not a problem.
One that I just had in my hand the other day, and I cannot remember now what it was. I found this book recently. It's called, and no one will ever have heard of this. Mm-hmm. It's called The Crime Book of J.G. Reader by Edgar Wallace. And I picked this up just because it has a very distinctive cover. It's got a great skull and crossbones design on the cover. And I bought it at, I think, some used bookstore in New York City about 6 months ago. And I had to come home and do a little research on him. And apparently J.G. Reeder was a very, very popular detective character back in the 30s. Sold, tens of thousands of copies, was very famous. No one knows who this guy is anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's a couple of novels in here. It's like a collection of several novels, and they're really good. There's the thing about mysteries, especially, is that, people have come up with these fantastic ideas about how to structure a story, how to fool the reader, how to misdirect you. And you hear about the really famous ones, like the murder of Roger Ackroyd or something like that. But there's thousands of these novels, and they're all really, really smart in how they fool you and how they bring you along. And you can't buy these books anywhere but used bookstores anymore.
Sure.
Because most of them don't even have, ebooks at this point.
Right, right.
Another one is similar story to that is it's more of a novella. It's called Murder in White. And it was republished the over in Britain. One of the publishing houses has been picking up older detective novels from the 30s and 40s and reissuing them. And this one was released last year, and it shot right to the top of the bestseller charts over in England. Just because it's a nifty story. It's about a group of people traveling on a train through rural England, and the train just stops dead on the tracks, and they don't know why. And there's only six of them on the train, and they get out and they start walking to see if they can go get some help. And they come across this cottage in the middle of the country. And when they go in, the place is, the fire is roaring, dinner is set on the table, music's playing, but there's no one there. And they decide to stay in the cottage to see if anybody comes back. And of course, one of them ends up dead before too long. And it's a great setup. It's well written. It's a charming book. And it's one of the rare moments where you see somebody get a second chance.
Yeah. Especially in publishing. That's very rare.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, believe me, I know.
Well, if someone is interested in learning more about you, where can they find you online?
I have a website at jeffreysomers.com, JeffreySomers.com. I also have a Twitter account at Jeffrey Somers. And I also have a Facebook. I have a personal Facebook, and there's also a Facebook page for fans of my writing.
Gotcha. Well, and I'll have links to all of those in the show notes so someone can take a look there. And again, we've been speaking with Jeff Somers, author of We Are Not Good People. The book is available in bookstores now, or download the ebook. And Jeff, thanks for doing this interview.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.